Welcome to this week's edition of KUAR's Week in Review podcast, where we take a look at the news from the week that was.
A former congressman from Pine Bluff has regrets over a law that stopped federal research on gun safety.
Questions of race and power continue to swirl in court around the state's takeover of the Little Rock School District.
Medicaid, as we know it, will look at much-anticipated changes proposed this week that could alter the future of health care in Arkansas.
Arkansas's Attorney General tries a long-shot appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court on a 12-week abortion ban.
And a secrecy law allowing the state to hide from the public what exactly is in its lethal injection drugs as execution dates loom.
Moving forward, one yard at a time toward the Environmental Protection Agency's Clean Power Plan.
Those topics and discussion from the KUAR news team is just ahead on the other side of this music bed. I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotajek.
I'm Chris Hickey.
And I'm Michael Heplin.
One of Arkansas's former congressmen, looking a few years back in the wake of this recent, most recent mass shooting on a college campus in Oregon, came out once again to say that he regrets some of his votes that may have prevented some federal research towards gun violence. Chris Hickey, you helped Morning Edition, I believe, produce a piece about Jay Dickey. Chris Hickey, can you tell us a little bit about the interview?
Yeah, Morning Edition was interested in a story that was published by the Huffington Post earlier this week, looking at research into gun violence and gun safety. They noted a 1996 appropriations provision in Congress that was sponsored or written by Jay Dickey, who's a Republican from Pine Bluff. He represented the 4th District in Congress from 1993 to 2001.
At that time, a rare Republican in Arkansas's delegation, too.
Right, and he was later succeeded by a Democrat, even Mike Ross, who we all know ran for governor last year. He is a big supporter of gun rights, still is, actually. Was considered the NRA's point man in Congress. So back in the late 80s and early 1990s, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention was using federal funds to conduct research on the effects of gun violence and treating it as a public health issue. There was a study that came out in the early 90s that they funded in part that described how homes with greater, higher instances of gun ownership also tended to correlate with higher instances of homicide. And that sort of became a political issue for conservatives in Congress. And they criticized the CDC and they called them out for possibly politicizing this research. And Jay Dickey heard that call. He inserted this appropriations language into this omnibus funding bill in Congress in 1996 that specifically stated that research on gun control should not be funded on the federal level. He interpreted that to be, or he says later, that he interpreted that to be a very narrow definition. He did not necessarily want to see, or he says now that he didn't want to see all research into gun violence or the effects of gun violence cease, as it effectively did. About $2.6 million in research was redirected towards other areas, and now the CDC and does very little, if any, research into the effects of gun injuries. Basically, Congress, ruling parties in Congress, took that language and basically applied it to all research in gun violence. So, Morning Edition Steve Inskeep talked to Jay Dickey after interest in this. And Jay Dickey had actually penned an op-ed in the Washington Post in 2012 after the Aurora, Colorado movie theater shooting with the former head of the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control, Mark Rosenberg, who at the time in 1996 was kind of a nemesis of Dickey, but later he kind of recanted his previous position on research. and they penned an article advocating for the resumption of this research. And after the Umpqua Oregon Community College shooting last week, there's been a swell of media interest in this, beginning with the Huffington Post, now with the Morning Edition. Anyway, so I spoke with Dickie a little bit after.
And I hope it's because we need to do something, and that what I've been saying and what my cohort Mark Rosenberg has been saying from Atlanta is picking up. But I'm afraid, what I'm afraid of is that because it's controversial, that it's getting picked up just because it's controversial, not what the subject matter is. And I think what we really need to have happen is we need to have civic club subjects be dedicated to this. We need to have speakers all over the United States that'll go and say, we can do something. The Highway Administration did something.
And that's the total opposite of a lot of people you hear after gun tragedy. A lot of Republicans will say this is not the time to talk about it. But this person is saying it is the time.
Right. And you see, you heard kind of there, he made a comparison with research on traffic accidents that began in the late 70s. Now, automobiles didn't have many safety measures up until the late 70s when things like seatbelts and so the Highway Administration then identified a problem, which was there are a lot of deaths and injuries resulting from car accidents, and they did research into the causes and possible ways to prevent this. And Jay Dickey and Mark Rosenberg from the CDC drew that comparison and say we need a similar type of program into gun injury prevention. I asked him later if this research could be coddled with kind of what we hear more in the national discussion with calls for mental health screenings and background checks. And here's what he had to say with that.
What I'm talking about is something altogether different. Not really altogether different from what the legislation was that we stopped, because the intent was proper. It was just the way it was carried out was improper.
So there he's referring back to how Republicans in Congress utilized that appropriations language to apply to all kinds of research into gun injury.
Jay Dickey's belief is that he really didn't intend for it to be a total ban on gun research. He was just worried about certain research being done as advocacy, and that he didn't think it would end up this way?
See, that's what he says now. Of course, like accounts from the time may differ with that, and it's hard to say exactly, but what's certainly clear is that he believes now that research into gun injuries should be resumed.
Still a long ways away from any idea of what that reform would be, but he thinks we should look at it at least with federal dollars.
Yeah, so that science could possibly lead to some kind of solution to some deaths. Of course, you know, no one's saying that mass shootings will cease as a result, but
Sarah?
What I heard from the interview was that he's saying this from the perspective of being a gun rights advocate, and that he thinks that the National Rifle Association would possibly even be willing to support some kind of research on some level of regulations if it was clear that there weren't certain types of threats to gun ownership. Where's the line for a gun rights supporter to be advocating for research?
I think he's saying that if we conduct research, what he wants to see are more safety measures involved that won't necessarily impinge on gun ownership for law-abiding citizens, but things like child safety locks. In the op-ed article, I mean, I know that sounds maybe to us like it's a bit low-key or, you know, not like it wouldn't be tremendously effective, but I guess his regret is that in the 20 years since nearly 20 years since this Dickey Amendment was inserted into the appropriations bill, that we just don't have as much data available to us or scientific research available to us to give us any answers. It's like it's impossible to really act in a specific policy way when we don't have anything concrete to look towards. Of course, there's been research done in the private scientific field, but on a federal level, there hasn't been a kind of thorough examination.
The Little Rock School District has been in state hands since last January, but the protest to the state taking over the district and dissolving the locally elected school board has not died down completely. We've had two instances in court this week where some Little Rock residents are claiming that the state acted perhaps based on some notion of racism.
Well, firstly, the state Supreme Court heard oral arguments this week in a case that was about somewhat procedural. It's about whether the state can claim sovereign immunity and not be sued by former school board members who say that the takeover was capricious and unfounded and therefore a violation of state law. And Pulaski County Circuit Court Judge Wendell Griffin was hearing a case, and he had denied this state's claim that it was immune. And then the Supreme Court intervened and put a stay in the proceedings of that case to decide the issue itself about whether the state has to go to trial over this at all. Then
the second case,
Little Rock-based Democratic representative, civil rights attorney John Walker filed a federal lawsuit with some wide-ranging claims that discrimination in the Little Rock School District about districting and also the conditions in schools, facilities, and educational disparities, along with the decision of the state to take over the board, all come together to result in unequal education for students of color and low-income students. And he's claiming that the U.S. Constitution's Equal Protection Clause is a basis for taking the state to court, rather, for the general state of education in the district.
And John Walker's claims go back several years, if not decades, of course, but his court filing also comes on the heels of the superintendent of the school district saying that they would, within the next year, open a middle school for primarily white, affluent West Little Rock and take possibly 5 years, maybe longer, to open a new facility in Southwest Little Rock, more impoverished, more minorities.
Yeah, and Superintendent Baker Curris was quoted in the Democrat Gazette this morning saying, you know, he's focused on his job and he's dedicated to building this high school in Southwest Little Rock, but he wants to go through this process of getting community involvement and building a high school from the ground up. And the district has under contract this possible site with a building for a middle school in West Little Rock. And as we talked about last week, that was a really contentious issue of the school board right before it disbanded as to whether building would be prioritized in that more affluent part of town or in the higher need area. So it does seem the way it's playing out at this time that the West Little Rock school is going to happen first.
Of course, this announcement from Curris that in the immediate, at least, they're going to focus on a West Little Rock middle school for primarily white and affluent students. This comes in the context of Curris only having this role and the state only having this authority to build a school at all anywhere, because they're supposed to fix 6 distressed schools in other parts of town.
Well, yeah, this is certainly just a complicated story and set of circumstances. The state attorney for the state, Lori Frino, argued in Supreme Court yesterday that this ties to why there was a need for the takeover, because these 6 schools were in academic distress. It was impacting thousands of students. And well, let's hear what she had to say.
Thousands of students are in these 6 schools that are in academic distress. The 3 of the high schools, of the 5 high schools, were in academic distress. Yes, the board came up with a plan. Parts of it the department agreed with, parts of it the department disagreed with. This was all presented to the board, and the board made their determination.
So Superintendent Curris is now proceeding with his role representing the Department of Education, and but the attorneys for the plaintiffs, Marion Humphreys, says the decision was capricious, that there was no basis for it, and that's what the Supreme Court is considering now.
Ladies and gentlemen of the court, not since the days of Orville Faubus has the state of Arkansas taken over the Little Rock School District. And it was taken over for arbitrary and capricious reasons. That makes it an exception to sovereign immunity.
The attorney for the Department of Education said that capricious standard is pretty high and that it would be hard to prove that there really was no basis for the takeover, and that really the legislature gave the State Board of Education that license to do. So the Supreme Court is considering this now. The district's proceeding with plans for building the schools. And John Walker is continuing to state his message that it all comes down to race.
It's very clear that the actions of at least two board members were racially motivated. We have alleged that in the complaint, and that the purpose was to take over the school district and prioritize the education of white children who happen to be well-to-do.
This is all about race, and it's about economics, and it's about who runs the city. I mean, how can you have a city which is more minority than it is majority, and all of the governance is in the Heights and in Chenal? I mean, it just can't be. All the people don't live there.
All right, Sarah, we've heard some initial arguments, oral arguments in the case of that, the Supreme Court case, and a filing by John Walker and the other one. Any timeline we should look forward to in getting all of this resolved?
You know, I guess the Supreme Court will rule in a couple of months, at least, about the question of whether the circuit court case can continue, and this federal case could play out for longer, I'm suspecting. The Healthcare Task Force has commissioned a report from the Stevens Group on going forward with health care reform in the state, issued a report this week. What were the findings?
This is a really big report, much anticipated. The Healthcare Task Force was set up by the legislature to try to figure out what to do when the private option expires at the end of 2016. So the biggest question from this report is, should we continue Medicaid expansion in some form, whether you call it the private option or call it something else? It was almost overlooked, and it was assumed, yes, we need to continue Medicaid expansion. And the reason why the Steven Group report said this, who are independent consultants hired by the task force, fundamental reasons. One, there's 200,000 plus people that already, low-income people that already get coverage from the state through the existing program. They said it's important to show compassion to them and to keep them covered in some way. The second reason is, over the course of the next 5 years, from 2017 or so to 2021, it saved the state almost $500 million. Even when the state has to start contributing more to the federal government for this Medicaid expansion. So that's the big question. And within that, there are, of course, many changes that they want to have proposed. And that's in part to start, in a few years, Arkansas will have to start paying part of the Medicaid match rate. So that's part of the reason they want the savings. The other reason is maybe to convince an increasingly conservative legislature that this is a good deal. So the changes to the private option itself, they want to call it THIP, which is supposed to mean Transitional Health Insurance Program. And the emphasis on transition is really important language to conservatives who don't like the idea of people staying put in welfare programs and not raising up to a different income status. And within that THIP program, there's a lot more cost-sharing involved. Right now, private option recipients don't really have to worry about premiums and things like that. And so there'd be kind of be performance-based cost-sharing. If you didn't meet certain wellness benchmarks, like going to a checkup in the first 90 days of getting your health insurance, they could give you a 2% premium cost. If they think you inappropriately went to the ER instead of going to a regular physician, they could give you a 2% premium cost. And this is one of the big ones, because Republicans want mandatory work training a lot of the times for this. If you're going to get this entitlement, so to speak, through Medicaid, they want you to make sure that you're working, and about 40% of the private option population might be unemployed. And so they want to make you work, but they'll give you work referrals and work training programs. And if you don't go to those, then you might get a little bit of a premium to pay. So that's part of the private option reform, some of the more burdensome things for beneficiaries to do that didn't exist before. There's also, which is kind of struck me as odd, the Stevens Group proposed expanding some services that are offered by Medicaid that the legislature had just won a hard-earned victory to get rid of in the previous year. So they're calling for giving dental and vision care and non-emergency transportation to people on the private option, which are all things that conservatives managed to kill in recent years. So that's one part, the changes to the private option. And then there's also changes to the larger system, traditional Medicaid, which has a little bit more, maybe 300,000, 400,000 people in it. So they called for improvements to DHS in terms of getting better at contract oversights and most importantly, getting better at figuring out how to verify if someone is actually eligible. We've been discussing the past several months that the state has kicked 50,000 people off their insurance programs because of a troublesome redetermination process. And we'll listen to John Stephen talk a little bit, the head of this firm. He pointed out that maybe 40,000 people in Medicaid and in the private option might not actually live in Arkansas.
Risk indicators that were found absolutely convince us that you have a problem that needs to be addressed. There are folks that are out of state, in our opinion, based on the data, that could have legitimately moved out of state, are not telling the department, and you're paying a PMPM every month to a carrier because you're not checking routinely if someone's moved.
Jacob, do you think that that is meant to give some credence to the Department of Human Services income verification checks and cutting off some Medicaid recipients in the last few months?
Actually, this finding that there are 40,000 didn't come through the Department of Human Services. The Stevens Group conducted their own independent analysis through various credit rating agencies and things, seeing where people's bills were, primary addresses. It does give credence. He wanted to point out that there's no evidence that it's fraud. It could just be people who legitimately moved and for whatever reason are still receiving coverage. And he wanted to emphasize to a lot of Republicans heard that and thought, well, I told you this program is full of waste and fraud like all government entitlements are. But he emphasized this is something that really could be fixed.
Well, earlier this year, there was some controversy when DHS sent out a letter saying that the private option was ending. And I wonder if this report, given that it's been fairly public, is going to be a disappointing message for some lawmakers who were elected and push this idea of ending the private option.
Yeah, I would say it would definitely be a disappointment. And it was to a few people that I spoke to that support ending Medicaid expansion, period, because it's part of the Affordable Care Act. Even if it saves state money, it costs the federal government money. And fundamentally, they don't like the idea of people getting a government benefit if they're not working. But a lot of these people, of course, are working. But some of the more fundamental changes to Medicaid beyond the private option and Medicaid expansion that they could adopt if they kill the private option or not is fundamentally they want to shift away from fee-for-services, like you pay $20 for X checkup, and they want it to be outcomes-based or values-based payments. And they say they can accomplish that through these things called episodes of care. Basically, they'll track you from emergency room to follow-up and recovery and things like that, and doctors will be compensated based on those things. And those methods have been proved to save some money for the state and improve the outcomes of patient health services. They also said another big way to save money, and I'll play another cut from John Stephen, is that Arkansas really needs to shift to community-based care. And there's this thing called the Community First Choice Option, which is another Affordable Care Act provision that Arkansas legislators don't like and so far haven't enacted.
Overly high utilization of nursing home and other institutional settings. We've talked about that at length. And there are barriers to community-based care that are not existing in other states that we have learned during the way, and we've identified some of them for you in the recommendations.
But we know that the nursing home lobby in Arkansas is very strong, things like human development centers, so there'll be a lot of resistance to that idea, and there has been the past few years.
Well, sounds like they've been looking around the country for some best practices that have proven and been discussed in other states.
Yep, and that's one of the things why they brought in this independent consultant that's not from Arkansas. They have experience with other states. They claim there are lots of best practices that can be applied, while also praising Arkansas's adaptation of Medicaid expansion, saying that other states have adopted that. But as you were saying, there are probably plenty of Republicans that did not like this report. And there was, near the end of it, there's a 25-page executive summary. It's like a 500-page report, what are called outside-the-box solutions. And that is the assumption that there is a Republican president elected who might have a difference of opinion about how flexible the Affordable Care Act can be. And they call these outside the box categories. They said you could still increase coverage, perhaps. There'd still be less people covered than are now. But if you did this in this alternative means, you could require them to work 20 hours a week. You go back to traditional Medicaid matching rates, which cost the state more money. And you could even give people a lifetime benefit so they could never spend too much state money on this sort of
thing. I'm kind of curious of the Stevens Group media. I'm kind of curious about the Stevens Group's reasoning behind reinstituting dental and vision. Was that
twofold reasons
okay.
why?
Yeah.
First reason was they said if you give people dental care, vision care, and not emergency transportation, which is especially important if you live in a rural area or disabled or elderly or something like that, it saves money in the long run because preventative care usually ends up saving money and stopping more costly chronic conditions being treated. So that's the first reason. And their second reason is that it would be an incentive to people that use the program properly. You could offer it like that. If you don't show evidence of a lot of ER visits, if you show that you can go to certain preliminary checkups and things like that, then maybe they could offer it as an incentive. If you're doing everything right while you're enrolled in the program, we could give you these extra benefits. There's been a lot of action on Planned Parenthood, abortion as of late. Much of it centered in Washington, D.C. over issues like fetal tissue research. But abortion is back on the table this week, particularly in Arkansas. This time a more straightforward, limiting access to the procedure by week. Michael, what's the news out of the Attorney General's office this week?
Well, the Attorney General, Leslie Rutledge, has decided to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court to consider a 12-week abortion ban that was passed by the legislature in 2013. Almost immediately, federal judge Susan Weber Wright found it unconstitutional. A three-judge panel of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals later agreed. The full Eighth Circuit did not hear the case, but on Tuesday, Rutledge formally filed the paperwork for the U.S. Supreme Court to ask them to consider the case. She acknowledges it's a long shot, but here's what she told me during a brief phone interview as she was running from one appearance to another.
We filed a petition for a writ of certiorari asking the U.S. Supreme Court to uphold the constitutionality of the Arkansas Human Heartbeat Protection Act. Essentially, what we are arguing in this petition to the court is that certiorari should be granted to allow the court to revisit and overturn the arbitrary viability rule. The viability rule provides that government may not prohibit any woman from making the ultimate decision to terminate her pregnancy before viability. We argue that Arkansas and other states should be allowed to advance their profound interest in defending the life of the unborn, which is exactly what the Arkansas Human Heartbeat Protection Act accomplishes.
And Michael, can you tell us a little bit about that viability argument? What is she talking about?
Yeah, this is essentially what the 1973 Roe v. Wade case established, that the limit was the ability for a fetus to survive outside the womb. That's generally considered to be 22 to 24 weeks into a pregnancy. And that's been the standard now for some four decades. So if Arkansas's law were to be upheld, it would drastically change what has been the established point in a pregnancy.
Cutting it in half, almost.
In half, exactly. So she acknowledges that this would undo about 40 years of court decisions. But as I said, she acknowledged it's a long shot.
Well, we are certainly hopeful that the court will accept our petition for cert. The court does receive 9 to 10,000 petitions each year, and less than 1% are granted a plenary review with oral arguments. But we are optimistic that they will, based on the arguments that we have set forth in this petition. And we believe that the state's interest in an unborn child's life does not begin at viability, but the state's interest begins at the outset of pregnancy, and that the presence of a fetal heartbeat could serve as that line which defines the state's profound interest in protecting the life of the unborn.
And the fetal heartbeat, that's been the key on this law, which was presented by State Senator Jason Rapert, was the point at where a fetal heartbeat could be detected, which he says is about 12 weeks into a pregnancy. The governor at the time, Mike Beebe,
had vetoed the bill, said it was clearly unconstitutional, and he was overridden by the legislature, which Republicans had made big gains the previous year, and they were easily able to override the governor's veto, and this became law until a lawsuit was filed by the ACLU. And I covered the court hearing in federal court before U.S. District Judge Susan Weber Wright when she issued the preliminary injunction against the ban that was to take effect in August of 2013. But I did speak with Jason Rapert after that hearing, and I went into my archives and pulled up just this sample, this one comment from him speaking to reporters after the hearing.
These preliminary things are just a part of the process. And I believe that every day when you're taking a human life, you're killing a child, we have to do more for prevention and education. And the balance was even mentioned in Roe v. Wade, that you have a right to regulate abortion at approximately the end of the first trimester and the beginning of the second trimester. And gentlemen, that's 12 weeks and always has been.
But it's just another step to chip away at abortion. Obviously, the goal is for these efforts to eventually make abortion illegal again. And that same year, we also had what the 20-week abortion ban passed. So even the same group of lawmakers passing two different bills, knowing that the 12-week ban would face more scrutiny. And was one of the most stringent in the nation when it was passed.
And worth noting that even though they overrode the veto of the governor in Arkansas, that only takes a simple majority. So it wasn't the they didn't have to rally extra votes necessarily for that. But I think all this, it's good to keep clear that while the measure in the rubric by Jason Rapert has been set at the heartbeat and detecting the heartbeat, the Supreme Court argument has been, as I understand it, has been about viability outside of the womb. So detecting certain signs of life inside the womb is not the same, I suppose.
Exactly. But the Attorney General still feels this is something that she would like the U.S. Supreme Court to take up. And while, as I said, she acknowledged it's a long shot, it's another effort just to try and bring this back, bring the abortion issue back to the Supreme Court. Obviously, we have different justices in place at this point, but there's just the hope that maybe arguing it a different way might bring something. So it's just a part of the continual challenge to abortion that we see in this country.
And it's something Leslie Rutledge has done on a number of issues, something she campaigned and promised to do to keep pushing the needle, even if the past few arguments in the courts haven't gone their way.
Exactly.
All right, Michael Hiblin, our news director, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It seems like we talk about this every week, but the reason why is we keep getting closer to the first scheduled execution date in Arkansas. The first one in 10 years, it'd be a double execution, but the question still remains, can Arkansas really execute someone while keeping a secret from the inmate and from the public what they're using to execute the inmate with?
That's right. Bruce Earl Ward is scheduled for execution on October 21st, and his attorneys filed another request for a preliminary injunction this week, and they say he's schizophrenic, he hasn't had a proper defense. Attorneys defending the eight inmates are taking every tack they can to try to delay and stop these executions, but their biggest argument is that the state isn't revealing the three-drug mixture that it will be using for the injections. In recent years, states have had a hard time getting the drugs they need to do these injections because companies that manufacture them don't want to be known for being tied to executions, and they don't want any kind of liability. And so the Supreme Court ruled earlier this year that Oklahoma's use of a three-drug mixture was constitutional, partly because the state had no better option to perform the death penalty, to perform executions. That state also has a law giving secrecy. So the way it works is the legislature passed a law indicating that the Department of Correction could withhold its sources for the drugs. And right now, Judge Wendell Griffin, who we've talked about in the context of the school lawsuit, he is weighing whether to dismiss the case entirely. And that's what the state's asking for. And so he had a hearing earlier this week and was considering the arguments that defendants of these inmates on death row have made, that the state, as I said, shouldn't have the right to keep the drugs secret because no one can determine if the executions will be cruel and unusual, and then also whether it's constitutional at all.
And the timing of this couldn't be more interesting. In Oklahoma this week, officials there admitted that they used the wrong execution drug for an execution recently, and the governor has since put executions on hold because of it. And it's one of those instances where no one got to know what that drug was, except for a few officials.
Yeah, so the Supreme Court case considered this drug potassium chloride. As it turns out, they used something called potassium acetate. And so the Jeff Rosenzweig, an attorney in Arkansas for the inmates, has filed a petition to say, look, this is a type of thing that can go very wrong when the state isn't admitting what it's doing. So Wendell Griffin said he's going to decide early next week whether or not to dismiss the case because of the timeliness of the issue, that, you know, these executions are scheduled less than 2 weeks from now. Having been in the room, it seemed that he was questioning the attorneys for the state quite a bit on the legitimacy of saying that there was no argument and there was no evidence to question the secrecy law and the use of those particular drugs as opposed to any other various methods in terms of what would be the most humane approach. So he seemed to, you know, it's hard to speculate, but he seemed weary of just dismissing the issue altogether, although he has been outspoken himself on his position on many of these issues. So anything that goes through his courtroom seems to be...
You've got to think about his personal position.
Yeah.
It's been a while now since we got a ruling about the authority of the federal government and the EPA to have this clean power plan, which in Arkansas requires some pretty substantial carbon emission reductions in the coming years. Chris, you went to a stakeholders meeting. You also talked a little bit this week with the administrator of the EPA who was visiting Little Rock.
That's right. Gina McCarthy came down to Little Rock to make a visit to look at and discuss with some local officials the developments along the Creative Corridor on Main Street in Little Rock. The EPA had granted the city a $900,000 grant in part to construct a water drainage system along the corridor that was intended to improve water quality in the area. It has a lot of foliage and soil and stuff that's intended to absorb water and rid it of pollutants and toxins and stuff before it flows into the Arkansas River and whatnot. So she was here for that, and members of the press also got to ask her about how Arkansas is doing with the with planning to comply with the EPA's Clean Power Plan. Now that is a controversial plan, challenged by many states, including our own in federal court.
Opposition from nearly all of our elected officials.
Right. And most especially our Attorney General, Leslie Rutledge, who's joined in the lawsuit with about 20 other states. And that calls for the reduction in carbon emissions from power plants around the country by about a little over 30% nationwide. In Arkansas, that target is about 36% by 2030 over 2012 levels.
Well done.
Right. So first, let's hear from Gina McCarthy about how she thinks Arkansas is doing in relation to complying with the Clean Power Plan.
Arkansas, frankly, has done some wonderful programs. They have been heavily engaged in energy efficiency, which is one of the least cost way to actually comply with the Clean Power Plan. They're building renewables in terms of one of the first large solar utilities in the state. So there's a lot going on, and we're looking to basically continue to encourage that, work with them, provide technical assistance, and hopefully every state will be able to see that there is a need to take climate action seriously and move forward now, but it can also be to their advantage, not just in terms of dealing with climate, but economically and for job growth.
Now, you heard her refer there to a solar facility that's being developed by Entergy Arkansas in the south part of the state. Now, one of the main criticisms to this clean power plan is that it would actually increase the costs of energy production and would fall on the backs of ratepayers. Now, this week, it so happened that her visit coincided with a meeting among various stakeholders in the region, mainly utilities, environmental groups, industry representatives, cities, municipalities, what have you, to discuss how the EPA, or excuse me, to discuss how Arkansas will meet the requirements of this clean power plan. There are something like 19 coal power plants in the state, which are the kind of the main targets of this plan. Coal produces the most carbon out of all power plants, and we get about 50% of our electricity from coal plants. There are a couple of building blocks, actually three building blocks, for a state to meet this plan. One is shifting more energy production towards natural gas, shifting more production towards renewables, and improving efficiency at the coal plants. And those are all efforts that the stakeholders group has to consider. Now, the first meeting was today. This clean power plan was finalized in August by the EPA. It still hasn't been published in the Federal Register, and there's a little bit of conflict there. Some of the parties in that lawsuit are challenging the EPA on saying that they're holding back the plan. But it's basically known to almost all parties involved what the basic outline of the plan is.
Stakeholders, we're talking about the state of Arkansas, energy companies, utility companies, Sierra Club, people like that.
Yeah. First, let me play a cut for you. This is Stuart Spencer. He's head of the air division at the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality. And he's talking here about how the EPA's clean power plan is also kind of enmeshed with a few other plans that are coming down through the pipeline. There's a regional haze rule. There's a rule on mercury. And this was at the beginning of the stakeholders meetings.
There are a suite of rules that have been rolled out over these past several years. Regional haze, mercury air toxics rule, clean power plan. The ozone standard was recently adjusted. And the question has been for several years, which one of those regulations is driving the bus? And I think that's different depending on which state you're looking at. For Arkansas, and I'll get to this later, there have been some proposals, some announcements made in conjunction with another rule that we're not here to talk about today, the regional haze rule, but it does tie into our discussion.
The regional haze rule had an effect on Entergy's decision to close down or to propose closing down its White Bluff power plant. And that will obviously, our White Bluff power plant, which is a coal-fired plant, which will obviously have effect on the state's carbon emissions. One of the takeaways from this meeting, the stakeholders meeting, which is conducted by the Department of Environmental Quality in conjunction with the Public Service Commission, is that there seems to be a consensus on among the stakeholders that the best approach to complying with this rule is to take a what is called a mass-based approach to carbon emission reduction as opposed to a rate-based approach. Basically, that means that there's the state's aggregate of the mass-based approach means that it's applying to the state's aggregate amount of carbon emissions as opposed to the rate-based approach, which is a method to reduce emissions based on megawatt hour. And one of the stakeholders, Ken Smith of the Arkansas Advanced Energy Association, which they run kind of a middle of the road. They don't necessarily oppose or explicitly support this plan. He kind of explains here why a mass-based approach to complying with the plan would be better in their initial.
I think it allows flexibility. I think it allows us to implement a wide suite of state measures from energy efficiency to renewable energy to combined heat power and waste heat recovery by our industrials. We think that the opportunities offered through the final rule for a multi-state approach working with the RTOs makes lots of sense and gives us the chance, as one of our RTO representatives said, of doing trading of emissions across state lines. We think that's a very important component.
So you mentioned there carbon trading, coordinating with other states in the region to achieve this kind of mass-based reduction. The same stakeholders who tended to be opposed to this rule spoke out against it again, even though when the rule was finalized in August, it was slightly less stringent than the initial proposed rule that was announced last year. Arkansas doesn't have to reduce its emissions by nearly as much. And that's seen as a good thing by a lot of stakeholders simply because of the means to reduce this, reduce carbon emissions would be less costly, essentially, and could be achieved realistically.
And you mentioned that people opposed to the Clean Power Plan were still there participating in the stakeholders meeting about how to move forward. Do you have a sense that even though there are still people clearly resistant to the EPA's authority to do this and resistant to the science behind the desire to clean up carbon emissions, do you feel like everyone's in a generally spirit, they're acting in a spirit of trying to comply with it as an inevitable thing? Or are there people who think if there's a Republican president, we won't have to do any of this?
Yeah, I think everyone at the stakeholders meeting expressed a cooperative spirit among parties, and they really see it as a reality. There are some groups that are, of course, hopeful that the state will be successful in its challenge to the rule in the lawsuit. But you know, meanwhile, environmental groups hope that it'll go forward, and it seems that the stakeholders meeting is being thought of well among the groups. And one other thing to point out is that there's a law passed in the legislature last year, Act 382, that requires any state compliance to go before the legislature for final approval. So it'll be developed
a political battle at some point in Arkansas.
Potentially. But there'll be a series of stakeholder meetings, and they'll meet regularly over the next few months. And by next September is the date when the deadline for submittal of the plan, and the legislature will have to approve it before then. So.
All right. Well, it sounds like we're certainly at a different place mentally about the ideas of complying than we were even a year ago. So more significant changes to come. Well, Chris, Sarah, Michael Hiblin, who joined us for one segment. Thank you, everybody. This has been KUAR's Week in Review podcast, where we took a look at the Little Rock School District, federal research on gun safety, the big changes coming down the pike for the state's Medicaid and private option plans, and we looked at the status of some court cases in advance of lethal injections that may be administered in 2 weeks. I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
Chris, thanks for doing our theme music.